Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we take complex, often jargon-heavy research, stack up the sources, and extract the precise knowledge you need to be seriously well-informed. Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into something that sounds, well, utterly academic. The Deutero-Isaiah problem.
It really does sound like something you'd find on a dusty syllabus, but trust me, this is foundational.
Okay.
For anyone examining the historical claims of the Book of Mormon, this specific issue, the inclusion of post-exilic Isaiah material, is arguably one of the most powerful and objective challenges to its historicity.
Exactly. We're not talking about obscure archaeological debates here. We are talking about a textual issue that most biblical scholars, you know, regardless of their background or faith, they all agree on.
Right.
This deep dive will frame how decades of mainstream biblical scholarship work, done entirely outside of any specific religious agenda, demonstrates a fundamental contradiction within the Book of Mormon's own source material and timeline.
And it's a challenge that even highly faithful, nuanced scholars within the tradition acknowledge. They know it needs a robust explanation.
Mm.
If the Book of Mormon claims to be a literal historical record translated from ancient plates, it has to account for text that, well, simply did not exist when those plates supposedly left Jerusalem.
Okay, let's unpack this then. We've established that the Book of Mormon uses massive chunks of the Old Testament Book of Isaiah, particularly in 2 Nephi.
Huge chunks, yes.
The problem isn't that this ancient American text quotes a Hebrew prophet. The problem is which parts of that prophet's book are quoted and when those specific parts were actually written.
And that's the key. The scholarly consensus is overwhelming.
Yeah.
The Book of Isaiah is not the work of a single author. The man we call the historical Isaiah lived and prophesied in Jerusalem during the 8th century BCE.
Okay, so that's the original guy.
That's the original guy. He wrote what we now call First Isaiah, which is roughly chapters 1 through 39.
And the timeline is so crucial here. The Book of Mormon narrative places Lehi and his family leaving Jerusalem around 600 BC.
Right.
That's 2 centuries after the historical Isaiah was active.
Correct. Now, look at the rest of the book. Biblical scholarship holds that the material from chapter 40 all the way through chapter 66 was written significantly later.
Later,
after the Jewish exile into Babylon. The Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem in 586 BC and carried the Jewish elite into captivity. That later material was composed during and after that exile.
And this is where the term Deutero-Isaiah comes from, right? The second Isaiah.
Precisely. Scholars typically label chapters 40 through 55 as Deutero-Isaiah, or the second Isaiah, composed during the Babylonian exile.
And then there's a third one, too.
Yeah, chapters 56 through 66 are sometimes referred to as Trito-Isaiah, or the third Isaiah, written even later during the post-exilic period when the Jews had returned to the land.
So we're talking about different authors writing to different audiences, dealing with entirely different historical circumstances.
That's right.
And this creates the direct, unavoidable conflict for the Book of Mormon. If Lehi departed around 600 BC, before the Babylonian invasion, the brass plates they carried could only have contained the work of First Isaiah.
Chapters 1 through 39.
The plates could not possibly have contained chapters 40 through 66, which were composed decades, or in some cases, over a century after Lehi left.
It's a chronological impossibility. And this isn't some marginal footnote. The material permeates the Book of Mormon.
Oh, yeah.
When you read 2 Nephi, which is presented as Nephi quoting his copy of the brass plates, you are reading large word-for-word chunks of Deutero-Isaiah. It's woven into the very fabric of the narrative.
So this requires us to ask, how do scholars know this? Why are they so sure this material is post-exilic? What are the specific fingerprints these later authors left behind?
It's not just one line of evidence. It's like four, all converging on the same conclusion. First, the specificity of the prophecy. It's just too accurate to have been written 2 centuries before the event.
What do you mean?
Well, Isaiah chapter 45 mentions Cyrus, the Persian king, who eventually liberated the Jews from Babylonian captivity by name.
Okay, but the traditional view would argue that's just a sign of divine foreknowledge, right? Prophesying a specific name, centuries in advance.
It would. But since Cyrus's decree to let the Jews return home didn't happen until 539 BCE, the simplest and most historically sound conclusion is that the writer was aware of the event.
Or even living through it.
Right, and composed the text after the fact. His historical documentation framed as prophecy, which was, you know, a common ancient literary device.
That makes sense. Okay, what's the second major clue?
The second is a dramatic shift in theological tone and historical context. The historical Isaiah, chapters 1 through 39, focused heavily on the judgment coming to Judah, but he fundamentally believed in the inviolability of Jerusalem.
The idea that God would never allow the city and the temple to fall.
Exactly, a message of divine protection. But Deuteronomy, which begins abruptly at chapter 40, starts with a message of comfort. Comfort ye, my people.
A completely different tone.
A totally different tone. This is a message delivered because Jerusalem has already been destroyed. The judgment has passed and the people are in exile. The text repeatedly describes the Babylonian period as the present historical condition, not some distant future event.
It's a different author addressing a different time.
Precisely. Third, and this is where the linguistic evidence becomes, well, undeniable, we see the intrusion of anachronistic language. The later chapters 40 through 66 show heavy influence from the Aramaic language.
Which is conspicuously absent from the first 39 chapters.
Completely absent.
So why does Aramaic matter so much?
Because Aramaic was the lingua franca of the Near East. It became the language widely spoken by Jews during and after the exile, replacing ancient Hebrew for a lot of daily purposes.
Okay.
Its inclusion in Deuteronomy dates that material squarely to the post-exilic period, when Jews were speaking Aramaic, not the pre-exilic period when Lehi left Jerusalem.
So the language itself is like a timestamp saying, I was written in the 5th century BC, not the 7th.
That's a great way to put it. And finally, we see the appearance of anachronistic biblical figures. The historical Isaiah in chapters 1 through 39, he never mentions Abraham. Not once.
Which is strange, you'd think.
Very strange for a foundational Hebrew prophet. But once you hit Deuteronomy, Abraham is mentioned multiple times.
And why is Abraham's inclusion an anachronism?
Because scholars note that the Genesis narratives, the formalized stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were first being collected and finalized after the exile.
I see.
It was a way for the exiled people to sort of reaffirm their identity and lineage.
Yeah.
The historical Isaiah wouldn't have had these foundational narratives available in their final form, but the later author, writing in Babylon, he certainly did.
So overwhelming evidence from history, theology, language, and narrative, all confirming that these specific chunks of Isaiah that appear in the Book of Mormon were composed after 600 BC.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where it gets really interesting. The problem for the Book of Mormon doesn't stop with ancient chronology. It's compounded by a clear, modern signature. Not only did the Book of Mormon include this anachronistic material, but it included the specific, flawed 19th century English version of that text.
This is the compounding, inescapable problem. The material isn't just historically impossible for the brass plates. It is copied virtually word for word from the King James Bible.
So this means we get all the KJV's known issues, right?
Yeah.
Mistranslations and errors.
Yes. But the ultimate textual fingerprint is the inclusion of the KJV's distinctive italicized text.
Okay, remind us what that is.
When the 1611 KJV translators were working, they sometimes added English words that were not in the original Hebrew or Greek manuscripts. They just felt the words were necessary to make the sentence readable in English.
And they put those words in italics to show they had added them.
Exactly. A 17th century editorial choice. And Joseph Smith, when supposedly translating the original pure Hebrew text from the brass plates, reproduces these 17th century editorial editions.
Yeah.
The text he produced was not only historically impossible for an ancient Jew, but it bears the clear editorial markings of 1611 English translators.
So just to make that really concrete for you, in one of the Isaiah passages quoted in the Book of Mormon, there is an entire phrase, "and my," that exists only because the KJV translators added it in italics for flow.
Right. It changes the meaning from the original Hebrew.
And that phrase just shows up on the plates. So the ancient prophet Nephi supposedly copied the Deuteronomy text and somehow knew to include the specific editorial editions made 2,200 years later by English scholars.
It makes the source of the material transparently clear. The text simply cannot be a literal historical record translated from ancient plates because the final version bears the signature of Joseph Smith's available contemporary sources.
Namely, the KJV.
Right.
So given the sheer weight of all this evidence, historical, linguistic, textual, sectary, we have to look at how apologists try to resolve this fundamental contradiction. What are the common strategies?
There are two dominant and often contradictory strategies. The first is what you might call the reworked prophecy theory, which tries to maintain the historicity of the brass plates.
And what's that?
The argument suggests that the ancient prophet Isaiah did make some general prophecies, and then a later scribe from the school of Isaiah reworked the text after the exile.
So they're claiming the later scribe, Deutero-Isaiah, was just editing the original, filling in specifics like Cyrus's name, because the prophecies were being fulfilled.
That's the core idea. The text itself isn't new revelation, just a post-facto editing of the old text to make it more current.
But that seems a little convenient.
Well, critics argue this position is created purely out of necessity. It ignores the scholarly consensus, which cites a complete change in authorship, language, and theology, not just light editing, but more crucially.
It still doesn't explain the modern signature.
Exactly. Even if you accept this theory, it utterly fails to explain the 17th century English italics. Why would a scribe in Babylon embed text that only makes sense through a 1611 English translation lens?
It just doesn't work. Which forces the adoption of the second and probably more common apologetic response, which is about the translation process itself.
Right. The theory of loose translation.
The idea that Joseph Smith just took a shortcut.
Yes. This argument says that when Joseph Smith was translating, he recognized Nephi's quotations of Isaiah, and instead of translating them word for word from the plates, he just deferred to his King James Bible to save time.
So the stone would pause.
Yeah.
And he'd copy the KJV text directly into the manuscript.
That's the claim. For huge chunks of text.
So what does this all mean then? The claimed divine process just stopped, and Joseph Smith essentially did a cut-and-paste job using a book he had on his table.
It creates severe logical and historical contradictions. First, it directly contradicts the most detailed, tight translation accounts we have from witnesses.
What did they say?
They stated that the translation was word for word. If Joseph didn't have the words written down exactly as they appeared on the stone, even spelling names perfectly, the stone would not change to the next words.
So you can't claim miraculous word-for-word consistency for, say, the spelling of Qumora, and then claim divine convenience and total editorial license for 20 chapters of Isaiah.
It undermines the entire claimed miracle. The pause-and-copy theory turns the translation process into an inconsistent patchwork. Secondly, it implies a profound divine inconsistency, or, as some critics call it, divine laziness.
Mm-hmm.
Why would God go to all the effort to preserve the pure word of Isaiah on the brass plates, only to allow Joseph to bypass it entirely and use a known, corrupted 1611 KJV text?
A text that has non-original, italicized words and mistranslations.
Just to save the prophet a few hours of work, it makes no sense.
It's the ultimate mixed message. It's like God provides a perfect ancient blueprint on the plates, but then tells the builder to use the slightly flawed, cheap lumber lying nearby just to save time.
That analogy perfectly captures the internal conflict. If the Book of Mormon is the most correct book on earth, why would 10 to 20% of its core text be intentionally derived from a version of the Bible that contains known errors and late editions?
Right.
The argument forces the believer to prioritize the apologetic need to explain the anomaly over the clear historical witness accounts of the translation method.
And this pattern of borrowing contemporary material to create ancient scripture is why the mixtape theory of composition is so compelling to critics. It extends beyond the New Testament and right into the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
The Deutero-Isaiah problem is critical because it really forces you, the listener, to make a fundamental choice.
The evidence leaves a clear, traceable fingerprint of 19th century composition. You have to choose. Either the Book of Mormon is a literal historical record containing divine revelations before they were actually written,
yeah,
and that God authorized the prophet to use a flawed 17th century translation to save time, or it is a 19th century text reflecting Joseph Smith's understanding, his theological environment, and his available contemporary sources.
The evidence from history, linguistics, and the text itself, it all seems to line up, pointing away from the claim of historicity.
And that fingerprint of the KJV italicized text is the strongest piece of evidence, because it brings a 17th century editorial decision into what's claimed to be a 600 BC ancient manuscript.
So here's the final thought for you to consider. If the Book of Mormon's historical claims require you to accept that a prophet could bypass divine tight translation to save time by copying text from a flawed 1611 Bible, including chapters that mainstream scholars agree had not yet been written when Lehi left Jerusalem, it raises an important question about the nature of the entire translation process and whether we can truly trust the historical claim of the plates.
This is a question only you can answer based on the evidence we've unpacked today.
Thank you for diving deep with us. We'll see you next time.